and I'm going to talk about take from the practice instructions section that's relevant to everybody here. Most everybody here. I think you're not yet a patchrobe monk, but you may be. You may be. You might be darning your socks, so that'd be all right. But it's titled The Family Business. The Family Affairs, The Family Matters. And it's a Hong Zhi's suggestions to those of us that are here to take care of Buddha's business and to perpetuate it. And I thank you, Dean, for coming from Cleveland and helping to perpetuate the Dharma. And this, I think, might be helpful as a guide, as any of us that do take care of the business. He offers some suggestions. Patched robe monks roam the world, constantly emptying and expanding their minds. Without the slightest remnant held inside, they can respond appropriately, not hindered by beings, not tangled up by dharmas. Openly appearing and disappearing, you can freely share. But if merely involved in intellect, you will be buried. If enacting pure maturity, then you can naturally journey at ease among the 10,000 changes without touching them and without turning away from them. Box and lid join and arrow points meet, harmoniously hitting the mark. Whether releasing or gathering up externals, eliminate all leaking. Such a person can fulfill the family business. From this place, just return. The white clouds enter the valley, and the bright moon circles the mountain. On this occasion, you have the same substance as the elders. So it is said that three people are propped up by one staff and lie down in one bed. Do not leave any traces, and inside and outside will merge into one totality as leisurely as the sky clearing of rain clouds, as deep as the water drenching the autumn. All of you, virtuous people, remember this matter well. Patched robe monks roam the world, constantly emptying and expanding their minds. So patched robe monks, I guess most of us have patched robes. And I guess the question is it a valid robe or invalid robe, or what does it mean? What is a patched robe? It means we took the bodhisattva vows to free all beings. He says, patched robe monks, so those on doing the work, the bodhisattva work, Buddha's work, roam the world. So we interact with the world. We're out there. And I was thinking, You know, our tradition has a lot of different forms and styles, and how much of those forms and styles do we take with us out into the world when we roam the world? And I don't feel too comfortable roaming the world in a juban and kimono and karomo with this patch robe. You know, it just feels like, hey, we're here in the world, and how do we enter the world? How do we roam the world? Now, roaming the world. There's one beast that roams the world quite elegantly, and that's buffalo. And I bring them up because they're quite superior to their bovine
relatives.
Yeah, I was going to say brethren, but there are a lot of females there too. So sisters and brothers. And there's this, he might even be a Buddhist monk, but he lives in east of the Black Hills in South Dakota. And for a long time, he raised cattle. And he had a real heck of a time with them in the wintertime because they would just not know what to do. And he had to go out and gather them up, whereas the buffalo knew how to traverse rough terrain. They knew how to find their way. They knew how to head into the cold. They would face into the cold. That's why their robe is in front. And they would face directly into the wind with their exposed rear. And then they would herd together to keep their warmth as best they could. So to me, roaming the world, a buffalo is a good metaphor for roaming the marketplace. Maybe not quite as delicately as patch robe monks will, but with gusto. So he says, patch robe monks roam the world constantly emptying and expanding their minds. So constantly emptying the mind and expanding the mind. So not bringing much with you when you're out roaming the world, but huge willingness to learn and inquire and study about it, to meet it. The next sentence is, without the slightest remnant inside, they can respond appropriately, not hindered by beings, not tangled up by dharmas. A thoroughly digested monk has few remnants left. And the remnants I see are things like basic instincts. And those are really difficult to eliminate. Our prejudices that are underlying assumptions of how we function in society, like being a white guy. There are a lot of I have a lot of unknowns that I don't see. And so to actually be able to meet, to somehow get to see those and deal with them and chew them up and spit them out and probably discard them because they're probably not necessary, is quite useful. So that this implies there's a lot of work that's gone into this patch robe monk who can respond appropriately, which is like what Dean talked about yesterday with intimate accord. And then not hindered by beings. Now, I got a real problem with this one. Not because people. Got a problem.
Sangha. Huh?
And not tangled up by dharmas. The goings-on of the business of the temple is just how to be untangled. And you probably have endless stories of Zen Center with the entanglements of dharma that happen. And fortunately here we're pretty... our numbers are few. And that probably helps a lot. But not tangled up by dharmas also is... brings to mind for me one of my first deep appreciations for the Heart Sutra, where all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They do not appear nor disappear, are not tainted nor pure, do not increase nor decrease. And as a scientist, as a geologist, as an engineer, you know, it's like, it really gave me a deep reassurance that this is it. You can't pile more in this. You know, things are changing. But you can't pack more in here than what's here. This is it. And it's moving. And being tainted or neither tainted nor pure indicates it's a perspective we have. What context are we looking at it from? Manure pile is a waste product to Vicky. It's pure gold to us. So, without the slightest remnant inside, a patchwork monk can respond appropriately, not hindered by beings, not tangled up by dharmas.
Sometimes, besides the teaching, sometimes dharmas are used as an expression of just... not just the Buddhist teachings or the Buddhist way, but also phenomena itself.
That's what I was referring to, as that it wasn't the truth is full, but that the phenomena world is doesn't increase nor decrease. And it just, it's like... You know, when you're in your 20s and you really want to know what the truth is. And it's like, so, and the Heart Sutra says, it does not increase nor decrease. For some reason, it just warmed my heart that the phenomena world is not other than what we get to have. And you can't pack 200 pounds of rock in a 100-pound bag. It's just like there are limits, and there are ways to tighten things up, but fundamentally there are no entanglements. Hongzhi goes on, openly appearing and disappearing, you can freely share. But if you are merely involved in intellect, you will be buried. And I think that's kind of a warning to priests and teachers to you will be buried if your intellect is, if that's all you're engaged in. I don't know if you have any examples. Yeah?
I was just entangled with entanglement and thinking of quantum theory, and you claim there's no entanglement. Einstein had a problem with the term, so.
But is that a fabrication, that entanglement? Or is it, do you think it's a true entanglement?
It seems tick, I think, even here or there, or both, in some sense, maybe neither.
Entanglement itself is just based on he who becomes entangled, the entangler, the one who perceives entanglement, right?
Yeah.
Does Percival think that way? Sorry.
But openly appearing and disappearing, I thought that was an interesting one too, because openly implies openly appearing. So you arrive at a circumstance and you openly appear means you bring your open heart and mind to the circumstance, you appear. And if you openly disappear, maybe you got to show and exit quickly to get out of a circumstance because it's time to go and you want to gracefully leave. But also the disappearing could mean just openly disappearing, that you are openly disappearing your ego, your small self, so to actually be present fully with this circumstance. The next sentence is, if enacting pure maturity, then you can naturally journey at ease among the 10,000 changes without touching them or turning away from them. And in the Jhulmir Samadhi, this comes from the Jhulmir Samadhi, turning away and touching them are both wrong, for it is like a massive fire. And maybe that's what these 10,000 changes are, the massive fire of conditions and preconditions that are behind and a part of the circumstance we're in. So to neither touch nor turn away, and that indicates a skill. Pure maturity is skillful means, intimate accord, to move at ease probably means you've been it through the cauldron, and thank you for using that. Sashin is like a cauldron, and there's deep cooking, and maybe overcooking, to where the noodles are limp.
Sorry about that.
But then again, maybe it's better that they digest more easily. But even a mirror, you know, our practice of a mirroring, it takes a cauldron to make a mirror. It takes a cauldron to heat the aluminum or silver that makes the reflective part of a mirror. And then two coats of paint to protect it. But with the familiarity of the conditions that result in what's before us, we function skillfully. And I want to bring up a circumstance with Kendra She was a school teacher, and in the last year and a half, she was not able to teach any more school, but she tutored. And she had one young 8-year-old who, his parents were really concerned with him, that he had a learning disability. And so she went and worked with this young man. And with her skill, she probably could see that, you know, he was having problems with math, but saw that he really didn't have any problems with math, and there was something else going on. And she asked him, "Did you have a bad experience with math earlier on?" And he said, "Yes. I had a teacher who called me dumb." And he was so determined to not do math that he didn't do math. And so he was considered by his parents to be like, there's something wrong with this kid, there's something wrong with his brain. And by Kendra just touching that precondition in this young man, it evaporated from him. And it's like he could fully, wholeheartedly dive into doing math because she had exposed this thing. And to me, you know, that was like one of the big, big gifts. You know, that made me weep when I heard that. It just was... that's what a teacher does. It's like she didn't lead him anywhere. She didn't teach him anything. She just opened and exposed what needed to be exposed. And then the boy's mother was in the other room and overheard this. And it was like a relief to the whole family, this thing. So that's skillful. Skillful means pure maturity, being in accord. Box and lid join, and arrow points meet, harmoniously hitting the mark. And then Hongzhi goes on. He says, whether releasing or gathering up externals, eliminate all leaking. Whether releasing or gathering up externals. I see that as what we have to do in our day. You know, we have to gather up our laundry. We have to go to the grocery store. They're all externals. We have to make arrangements so people can show up. So whether gathering or releasing, eliminate all leaking. And leaking is generally refers to attachments, to aversions, to passions, to preferences. And so in that process of gathering and releasing, there's an unencumbered aspect of that activity that treats it all with the due accord, without being greedy, without being dismissive, to make full use of the goods. This is a family business. There are vendors, there are and suppliers and clients, there are employees, There's the structure of the organization. It's a business. This is a business. There's a continuity that is thought about in businesses of going from day to day to keep things moving so that the employees are taken care of, that their lives are adequately provided for, that what is given is of quality that you want to provide.
Right. Maybe a slightly different aspect of leaking. Sometimes when I've been in positions of danger for some long time, and I come to town, and someone makes a loud noise in back of me, I don't jump. So one aspect of that kind of leaking is more immediate physical, almost a physical release. Mm-hmm. Instead of maybe your passion leaping out, or your anger leaping out in terms of some interaction, that just doesn't happen. And I think in many of the things that Hung Shi is speaking about, it has these broad connotations, as you say, but some of them are quite pure, and at least I can identify them with immediate perception and reaction.
That's pretty refined. I mean, but you say you come from circumstances of danger.
Well, suppose I'm for a summer out mountaineering, real mountaineering. After a while, I don't respond to the same things I've responded to so much, at least for a little while, until a while. But beyond that, I use that just as an example. My sense of leaking, which is why I mentioned that, I wanted to say that, is this matter of one can almost feel the relaxation in dealing with difficult situations that would ordinarily push your button, but your button isn't pushed. What would come out doesn't. And so that's a mark of this great stability.
Mm-hmm. But it takes practice. It takes being in danger or being in circumstances where maybe you have a perspective, like being out mountaineering.
It's not perspective. It's not a thought. And it doesn't. I wouldn't say that it necessarily requires that. It's an example that I can give for myself and can testify to for myself. But I think it's broader than that.
Mm-hmm. So he says, gathering, releasing and gathering externals. No leaking. I guess I was stuck on the externals and the gathering and the releasing, but I guess you can look at the sounds of the world around you coming in. They gather in your ear, and you have a chance to respond. We respond.
I don't know that I can explain it more. I look for myself, how am I going to fulfill Dogen's instructions on how to sit. I can only speak about the immediacy that I know when that great stability occurs, there's no leaking. And I think that might be part of it when she was speaking about.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps it could be something to do with non-dualism. Non-dualism. A big part of training is not to see people as opposites, for example, not to have enemies, not to, you know, and that would be leaking of emotions, leaking of, you know, your own fixed belief system. And I thought I had made it when I was at the monastery. I went to a teacher and said, oh, I no longer have anyone as enemies. I just love everybody. And she said, really? How about people who abuse children? And I went, well, they do. And she went. And that's why I put that prayer to Kuan Yin up in the kitchen. It's a really good one to work with, not having that dualism going on. So the gathering, what were the words?
Releasing and gathering of externals.
Releasing and gathering seems to me
I kind of look at it, think of it as that opportunity for practice, you know, and it's, you know, it's like you have the norms in life, you know, what we would call the norms, and, you know, it's kind of that real opportunity for practice when something is, you know, like what you talked about, it coming into it and having this whatever it is that we're faced with, you know, the looking at it, you know, taking that second, you know, to look at it and reflect on it and not having that habitual reaction to it, you know, because we have all that. What is it in the Lankavatara? What does he call it? Our storehouse consciousness. You know, we've got this whole storehouse of how, you know, things happen. You know, it's really, you know, we have that opportunity.
I think we're tested, and we rarely don't leak. I remember one time something happened really quickly, like, you know, like a horn going off behind me. It was something different, completely different, and I was really surprised in my reaction that I didn't get mad. I didn't, you know, that it actually it was like, oh. There was a stability about the whole circumstance. And I thought, wow, it was instantaneous that reaction manifested. And it showed there I've come a little ways, got a long ways to go, but still, how to keep working with the storehouse consciousness, our base instincts, our lizard brain, as Angie would call it, and still be virtuous people, do the work that we need to do.
I was going to add something else. I like the externals. How did it go again?
Whether releasing or gathering up externals, eliminate all leaking.
I like the joining of those two very much. So it meant the impression I got when I heard that was that there's a kind of an adept or one who's free of leaking is somewhat adaptable to circumstances. So they're what's that term? Prashabdi, the Sanskrit term. It means you're kind of you're familiar with a situation or you're relaxed in a situation, but you're also pliable. In other words, like you can respond to this and you can release that, or this happens and you can take that when it's necessary to take that. You respond to conditions, and you're adaptable. You're not sort of fixed on mm-hmm. just releasing, or you're not just fixed on just taking, but you're pliable. Mm-hmm. You know, pliable means you're able to be taught. You're able to receive impressions from the world mm-hmm. or from yourself, from the whole situation. So that you can respond appropriately. So you're kind of mm-hmm. so pairing those two kind of impressed mm-hmm. me somewhat.
Yeah. Sounds like a time to reap, a time to sow. Yeah. We respond to the environment, the situation, appropriate.
But that flexibility is kind of inherent in that mm-hmm. statement. A bit, isn't it? You're kind of.
A couple months ago, I read it. I don't know where I read it, and I shared it with our sangha. It was. Between stimulus and response is an opportunity for growth and freedom. And I think of that often because, you know, it's that like that moment that we take to, you know, be aware and think about our response instead of just going to the storehouse and having our habitual response.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, patchwork monks roam the world, constantly emptying and expanding their minds. Without the slightest remnant inside, they can respond appropriately, not hindered by beings, not tangled up by dharmas, openly appearing and disappearing, can freely share. Enacting pure maturity without touching or turning away, harmoniously hitting the mark, whether releasing or gathering up externals, not leaking. Such a person can fulfill the family business. Take care of the Buddha temple. So, he goes on to say, from this place, just return.
What do you think that means? From this place, just return.
Well, you can't stay. You got to return mm-hmm. in order to come back to this place. So there's just move on, move along.
Don't you think that's like, because I was just reading something on his other, on the grass hut, and he said that in there, except for it was something else than just return. And I took it to, you know, that we have these stimulus. We have all of the scenery going on. And we act within that. But then we turn back in to ourself. You know, we turn the mirror back. We look back inside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was kind of what, but I can't remember what he said before, but that was how I took it.
So return is like check in with yourself.
Right? Yeah, that was what he was talking about. See, was
see what's wholesome, what's not wholesome. See
back.
What works.
Yeah.
See what's appropriate.
Yeah. Because if we don't do that, we just get scattered. Just get.
On this occasion, you have the same substance as the elders. So it is said, three people are propped up by one staff and lie down in one bed. So the three people propped up by one staff. I can imagine Curly holding the staff and turning around and knocking down Mo and Larry. Or the Marx brothers climbing over each other up the pole or something creative. But three people are propped up by one staff. Is that me, myself, and I? Is that the becoming, the abiding, and the decaying? Is it the past, present, and future of us? And all lie down in one bed. What do you think that means?
I think it's he's talking about the three jewels.
Three people are propped up by one staff.
I took it pretty much like the self, this, like you said, the self that actually is existent, the kind of precursor of that self, and the self to be, or the self, the potential self, mm-hmm. the self. I took it that way mm-hmm. when you first read it. And it makes sense that held up by one staff. Staff is usually a monk, staff to wander around, mm-hmm. to go, to function. So it would be the three. Maybe you need all three to actually hold the staff and to go. Mm-hmm. And to actually rest or finish or even release it. Maybe you need all three together.
You can't function without all three. Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to throw some folly into this too, and that's why
Larry Curly and Mo.
I thought, they were exquisite at what they did.
God, they were.
And they were very skillful. There were skillful means involved in their foolery. And maybe, I wanted to have just introduce that notion too, that it not all just be pure maturity, that there be some other aspects there too, but
no, you're supposed to get like this. What's the other one?
I only watched them because of my brother. And then he tried all the stuff on me.
There was something like
that. Do
you remember that?
Because they went under the chin.
Yeah,
and then when they reacted again, they hit them. Yeah, they distracted them.
Who are these?
Oh my God.
They're all Scottish. they're a comedy team. When was it? The 40s or 50s maybe?
30s through 1930 through 1975. They were
that long?
That long.
Really? Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Anyway, and it was like outrageous slapstick comedy, yeah. But it was also, they were abusive to one another. Yeah. They were
That's the part I didn't want.
But it was funny. It was so funny.
I thought, why would I be hanging around someone that be, you know, all this? I just, you know.
I grow up and read all these Zen stories about getting smacked around, and I could relate. I know what that's about.
So, near the end of this whole thing, he says, do not leave any traces. An inside and outside will merge into one totality. As leisurely as the sky clearing of rain clouds, as deep as the water drenching the autumn. Do not leave any traces, and inside and outside will merge into one totality. And part of living in community is trying to not leave traces. And in our, kind of on a practical note, I also spend time at this house in Oakland where there are some young men in their early 20s that don't know about leave no trace. And so it's actually helpful for people to understand how to function in group, to know when they leave a trace and that it's inconsiderate to others. So that kind of polishing goes on here, and it goes on in Oakland too, and maybe in most households.
Some households.
A few households.
A few households.
Maybe. Maybe one. Maybe none.
I did a study of that some years ago, probably 10 or 12 years ago, with a Zen group out in Vermont. And it was interesting. It really changed my... I mean, my mother pretty much taught us to pick up after ourselves and be traceless. But after I did this month-long study of that, it was like, yeah, it's really interesting when you start realizing all the, you know, traces that we leave, you know. And then just the other day, I was again reading about, you know, our carbon footprint. And it's just amazing how unaware, totally, you know, just unaware.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, family business. I think they're useful for those of us that are in this business. Okay.
May our intentions be good.